This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Historian and educator Frank Stevenson is a welcome voice on our show. He is a library of untold stories that reveal the character of Northeastern North Carolina. And as director of Chowan University's Upward Bound program, he also keeps us apprised of the progress of his students. Today we welcome Frank back to the program to talk about his 25th book. It centers on basket making. Now think about it. Those of us of a certain age remember seeing bushel baskets and 1 and 2 quart fruit baskets everywhere, and stuff that's everywhere has to come from somewhere. Chances are the baskets you saw came from the Riverside Manufacturing Company. It was once the largest basket-making factory in the world, and it stood in Murfreesboro, North Carolina. Frank Stevenson, welcome back.
Thank you, Frank. What a pleasure. It's always a pleasure to be here.
It
such
is great.
Such a joy.
It's great to have you here. Now, tell us about the Riverside Manufacturing Company. How big was it in its heyday?
In its heyday, it was, of course, the world's largest, but it employed over 600 people on two shifts and was turning out somewhere between 15 and 25 million baskets a year.
15 and 25? Where were they going?
They were going, of course, all over the U.S. They were going to Canada. They were going to Cuba in large quantities of them.
Well, tell us about, there's a great story about how this factory came to be.
It's a wonderful story, an amazing story. It all started in 1911 when two New Jersey basket makers, George Blizzard and William Dilks, got on a train and headed south. And their mission was, they were looking for gum trees to actually make baskets at their factory in Vineland, New Jersey. Well, for some reason or other, they decided to get off in a little North Carolina town called George. It's a little spot in the road. It's actually a suburb to another small town, Woodland, which is all of this is in Northampton County, North Carolina. And the Woodland is a Quaker community. But it was late afternoon when they got off. They had seen large stretches of gum trees from the train, so they got off in George. And it was late afternoon, getting close to dark, and there on the platform was a 8-year-old boy who had been sent to the train station to take the mail sack to the train from the Woodland Post Office. And the young boy was named Edwin Pierce Brown. And out of that, those two men, they were looking for a place to stay that night. So he said, well, come on, go with me. My father will put you up.
Oh, no. This doesn't end up in the barn and a farmer's daughter, does it?
No.
Okay,
not quite.
Right.
But that began a great friendship between a particular George Blizzard and the Brown family of George N.C. And Mr. Brown's father agreed to ship gum trees back to New Jersey for the for George Blizzard and his partner. Yeah. But in 1914, Blizzard and Dilks, they set up a factory. The first basket factory in Northeastern North Carolina was actually set up by the two New Jersey men in George. And so about that time, Edwin Brown and his two brothers were going to college, and in the summer, they needed jobs, so they worked in the Blizzard basket factory in George, and learned to trade. So when Edwin Brown graduated from Guilford College in 1926, he came home and he was headed to go up north to go to a business school, but the basket making process had got into his blood, so he decided that he and his two brothers were going to Murfreesboro and take over a defunct sawmill. And they turned that into the basket factory that became the world's largest one. That was in 1927. They employed on first about 15 men, making about 50 baskets a day by hand. And then as that process grew, they acquired basket making machines, and it just grew until all of a sudden they were employing 300 or 400 and then 500 or 600 men making 30 different kind of baskets. Of course, the main one that was made out was the bushel basket. Some people call them peach baskets, or potato baskets, or just plain bushel baskets, because it's a very useful product. But they made all kinds of baskets there, from a half bushel to peck, half peck. They made the 20-quart tomato basket, which was a cone-shaped basket. They made a 32-quart bean hamper, which was also a cone-shaped basket. And then they also made special baskets, for example, special crates or baskets. Say, for example, a couple of years they made these small crates for the fig growers in Michigan. And so they made different kinds of things.
Once their reputation, you brought a few of them here. Yes. Of course, everybody's going to remember these things. You know, these bushel baskets, which, as I say, you know, these things used to be everywhere.
Yes.
And they're staple. They've got, you know, bands around the center and around the top. Yeah. And the designs, I guess, are different from basket to basket, huh?
Somewhat. I mean, the early baskets started out that they would have a solid bottom, and then that got a little. It was easy to make the baskets just like the one that you had in him, because that's a bent bottom basket. The whole thing is bent. It's wet and then it's put into a mold and bent in shape.
Yeah.
And then let dry.
And the center, it comes up a little bit, which I assume bears weight better.
Yes,
than you've got some.
Yes.
And gum trees are important. Why gum trees?
Well, because they're cheap. You don't use them now in construction because they're not real weight bearing. And plus, they're cheap and they call them trash trees.
Mm-hmm.
But they're real pliable. They're real easy to bend. And plus, there was just an endless supply of them.
So how important was this factory then to the economic life and social life of Murfreesboro?
Oh, great. I mean, it was a mainstay. I mean, a small town like that employing 600 people, have a payroll like that. I mean, that was enormous. Had a huge impact both on the people making a living there, but also the people who operated and ran it. They were very generous. They were Quakers, and they were just really nice people. I grew up with some of their children, and in fact the chairman of it, Edwin Brown, who was the 8-year-old boy that George Blizzard met on the tracks in Woodland, and George, one of his daughters was in the same class with me for 8 years until the family sent them to the Quaker High School in Westtown, Pennsylvania. So,
did you ever work at the factory?
No, I didn't. But I had six family members. I worked there. My father worked there for a while, and then I had two uncles. I had a sister who worked there, and then my oldest son worked there one summer while he was in college, loading baskets into railroad cars and tractor-trailer trucks.
Yeah, I mean, you don't think about it, but now when you've got a factory that size shipping that many baskets, that generates a lot of other support industries
around it.
So
yes.
There's a lot of other work. In fact, the company was so big and so important, I guess, they issued their own money. You've got photographs of the coins they minted.
Yeah, they had their own script. And at first, they were usable there in the company store. But as time went on, the stores in town and merchants accepted money because they knew they could take it to the company office and get reimbursed.
Any of these coins still are? Some of them are great because they've got baskets on them, and the designs are really kind of cool.
Yes. Yes. It's very neat stuff.
Yeah.
They didn't have any paper script money, just the coins.
So what caused, you should pardon the expression, the bottom to fall out?
Well, basically a couple of things was that But the main issue was that the changes in the packing industry itself, instead of bushel baskets, you started to see a changeover to cardboard containers, wax-covered cardboard containers inside, also wire-bound crates and plastic containers. So that really sort of led to the demise of it.
And it was a slow decline through the 80s, but the company was still going up until 1995.
Yes, yes. And then it finally closed, yeah.
And what's going on there at the site now?
Well, actually, in 97, the main part of it burned in the case of arson, which has never been settled. That's two warehouses that's left, and the site is just it's just quiet.
Fascinating story. Yeah. And before I let you go, I want to find out about Chuan University's Upward Bound program. You've talked about that before. Still going strong?
Yes, still going strong. Still have remarkable success stories of students who went through there. We've been going for 34 years. We have 3,000-plus graduates of the program. And just wonderful, remarkable success stories of students who came from families who neither parent had a baccalaureate degree, and gave them an opportunity to go to college.
You got one of those stories for us now?
Yes, I have. In fact, the head of the Federal TRIO programs over at UNC Chapel Hill is a graduate of the Chuan Upward Bound program, Dr. Gary Bryan Williams, and she assumed that position on July 1. And she's just a remarkable story.
That's amazing. And you and now you're applying for a grant. You hope to be able to do it again.
Yeah, 5 years. I hope to get another 5 years, which would give me 40 years with it.
That'd be fantastic. Frank, and how many students have been through there again?
Over 3,000. From Hertford Bertie in Northampton Canyon, North Carolina.
Fantastic. Frank, always a pleasure to talk to you.
Absolutely, Frank.
Frank Stevenson, director of the Upward Bound program at Chauhan University. His 25th book, recently published, is an account of the Riverside Manufacturing Company of Murfreesboro, North Carolina. Just ahead, a journey of reconciliation, one of the earliest efforts to end bus segregation. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned.